Morning, everyone. So I read this study, maybe a few years ago. It was about happiness. And the premise of this study was that people are unhappy because, for really one reason and one reason alone, because they spend a lot of time thinking about the future. This is why people are unhappy, according to the study. And if you think about it, thinking about the future doesn't seem all that bad, does it? But according to this study, we're really bad at it. So when we think about the future, we imagine that we will succeed spectacularly in almost every single thing we put our hand to. We might even imagine, maybe this is not you, this is definitely me, people praising us and lauding our accomplishments after we've done them. We're unhappy because we think that we will succeed in almost every little thing that we do. Or some of us are pessimists. Some of us imagine that we will fail in everything that we do. But the reality is somewhere in between. Not succeeding all the time or even failing tragically and never living down the embarrassment, but rather somewhere in between. And we build up all sorts of strategies. Because what happens when we arrive in the future, according to this study, is that it doesn't match what we imagined, and so then we're unhappy. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Thinking about the future, arriving in the future, it not matching the thing that you imagined, then all of a sudden you realize, well, that doesn't match, and then you feel disappointed, you feel discouraged, you arrive in the present, and the present doesn't match what you imagined. And so you're unhappy, according to Dan Gilbert from Harvard University. Maybe you've heard of it. Anyway, we're unhappy because we arrive in the present. The present doesn't match what we imagined, and this is especially true of hard times. Nobody likes to imagine suffering. Nobody likes to imagine that your future will be full of persecution or full of trouble or full of extended times of being down. And then disappointment, even despair, often accompanies trouble in the present because you couldn't imagine how you would have ended up there. And so then you build strategies to armor yourself up against that disappointment. My wife has one: low expectations. She told this to me early on when we first started dating. I have low expectations. I'm like, what does that mean? What does that mean about us? Anyway, low expectations. Or you might play the blame game. Has anyone ever gotten sick and blamed it on someone else? Or you talk to someone and they were like, man, I heard you've been sick for the past week. And they say, yeah, my wife gave it to me. Or yeah, my friend gave it to me. Or yeah, I shouldn't have gone there because they gave it to me. You just look for ways to displace where the trouble actually came from. You have a strategy for how to deal with disappointment. And I want to tell you that Hebrews offers another far more potent way. So we've been looking at Hebrews. We are almost to the close of our series. Hebrews, we're going to look at Hebrews chapter 12 today. And then we will look at Hebrews. We'll go backward and we'll look at Hebrews 11 for Easter Sunday. But if you've got your Bible, you can turn with me to Hebrews chapter 12. We're going to look at a few of the most famous verses in the Bible. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. This is the word of the Lord. So you might recall that when we started this series maybe a few months ago, we began the series by asking if you had like a metaphor for life. If you thought about life a certain way, and we talked about different metaphors, we talked about how life can be like a game, Life can be like a garden. Life can be like a story. Life can be like a journey. We talked about journey, and there's a commentator named Luke Timothy Johnson who describes the book of Hebrews as a journey, as a pilgrimage to our true country. And now in these verses, we have another metaphor, race. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. So if you were an ancient person, this would have put in mind the Olympics. And interestingly enough, the word the writer in Hebrews uses for race is agon. Okay, so this word actually is referenced again later down in the chapter in verse 4, and it's translated not as race, but as struggle. In your agon, in your struggle against sin. And basically what Hebrews is telling us is life is a race, and this race is a struggle. Raise your hand if you would agree. Life is a race, and it's a struggle. Yes, most of you would. Some of you will. Anyway, now, life is a struggle. And if you were a listener of this letter, you would have totally understood that. You would have identified with the metaphor because as we have learned through the series, we've learned that the people that were listening to the letter were being persecuted. This is why the writer of the Hebrews is so insistent on hang on until the end because he knows they're experiencing trouble. And so he is encouraging them over and over again. Again, he points to the diadem, the diamond of God's love, Jesus Christ, gives all these different descriptors for who Jesus is, meant to encourage the people as they are on this marathon. He's concerned that they'll give up. The writer's concerned that in the race, people will give up. Running the race then, as he says, requires perseverance. It requires endurance. Endure the struggle. Endure the agon. Life is a race. Life is an agon, and we must struggle through it. And I have to tell you, endurance is not what the world tells us to do when it comes to struggle. The world does not tell us that your strategy for struggle should be perseverance, should be endurance. The world, I think, rather tells us, avoid the struggling. Because avoidance represents a certain type of thinking. If I'm suffering, I've done something wrong. Has anyone ever thought that? Trouble comes, you're like, what did I do to deserve this? Anyone? Yeah. You know, like in my first job as a pastor, I was a single guy and I went on vacation for a few weeks, or a couple weeks, not a few weeks. And I think I met up with some college friends. It was our first sort of big boy trip. We were adults now. We were testing our newfound adulthood. And so we went to Vancouver, British Columbia. We went to hike and we went to eat sushi. I was more interested in eating sushi. And so then we had a great time. Then I come back and I found out, when I come back, I find all of these things have gone wrong, including my brand new Honda Accord was leaking oil so badly that when I would drive, when we were taking it to the mechanic, it was leaking oil so badly that I had to stop every few miles to buy a bunch of whatever quarts of oil, I guess. And every few miles, I'd have to stop to replenish the oil. I'd have to keep driving, stop, replenish the oil, keep driving on the way to the mechanic. And so I called a mentor of mine, said, would you please drive behind me? Because I don't know what's going to happen to my car. And he said, of course I will. And he's a strong Christian, mature man. And he gets out of the car. He arrives. He turns up. I'm like waiting in front of the car. We're going to take it to the mechanic. He turns up. He opens his car door. And he looks at me and he says, what did you do on your vacation? What did you do? And of course, we just ate sushi. And we hiked. Well, we didn't hike that much, but we ate a lot of sushi. Anyway, he said, well, what did you do on your vacation? I mean, and it turns out the car had a recall notice on it, so the problem was with the oil, and so it was fixed for free, which I said, no, it was fixed for free. I held that in his face afterward. But anyway, I don't actually blame my mentor for thinking that way, because it's in the water. If you've got trouble, if you've got suffering, if something bad happens to you, well, you've done something to deserve it, or you have not worked hard enough to avoid it. Now, listen, Christians, we understand that suffering is a natural outcome of this disease I talked about a couple weeks ago, the moral rot problem. We live in a fallen world. It's broken. It's lanced through with sorrow and pain because of the introduction of rebellion in a garden, because of cosmic sin. And so now then death becomes the sovereign power of the world. And so we as Christians understand that Christ came to defeat the sovereign power of death, to defeat cosmic sin, to redeem and to restore all of creation, to put it back to rights. This is how we as Christians understand suffering, how we understand that trouble comes. Trouble comes because we live in a broken world, as C.S. Lewis talked about. We live in the kind of broken world that requires redemption. Suffering teaches us. It's a megaphone that communicates to us this particular kind of truth. But I want to tell you, the world does not think that way. The modern Western world thinks differently. Most modern people are, whether they realize it or not, they're humanists. And this is what humanism means. Humanism means that human is God. I'm a God, and so are you. That's basically what humanism teaches. That means that our destiny is in our own hands. We make our own fate. There's nothing more powerful in the universe than you or me. This is what humanism teaches you. And if you go to a university, a modern university, then that's going to be in the water. Humanism will be in the water. And it leads to all sorts of kinds of issues. Humanism does, by the way. We don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but I want to tell you that the idea that suffering should be avoided comes from humanism. When you have power enough to control your own destiny, as humanism teaches, well, if you are suffering or if you've got trouble, then you've done something wrong. If you're a humanist and you've got trouble, you've done something wrong. And then if you've got trouble, you look for a technique then or a strategy to solve it. That's what humanism teaches, because you should have power enough to avoid trouble. It's in the water. It even seeped into my mentor's thinking. A strong, mature Christian man, it seeped into his thinking, and I believe it seeps into ours too. I want to preach the gospel to you today. We're not humanists. C.S. Lewis explains in The Abolition of Man, for the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. In other words, wisdom. Wisdom so that you would endure. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique. And so ancients understood that you would conform your life to reality, whereas modern people or humanists believe that reality is something to be subdued to our wishes. Reality is something that we bend to ourselves, to what we want. That's what humanism actually teaches us. Hebrews tells us something else. Reality is that life is an agon. Humanism teaches reality is that life is something that you bend to your own wishes because you're a god. That's what humanism teaches. The ancients understood that what was required is wisdom, knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. Agon's going to come. You've got to endure the agon. You need knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. Humanism teaches us you need technique. And if you're suffering or if you've got trouble, that means that your technique or your strategy is inadequate. You need a better one. You've got to get a better one. You need a better kind of strategy. If you've got bodily suffering, well, let science give you the answers. If you've got family trouble, well, read a book. Go to a seminar. Learn how to discipline your children properly. You got social suffering? Well, learn a new way of dealing with bullies. You've got hardship? Well, get a profession that makes you a ton of money. Now, I'm not here to tell you that technique is all bad. Technique can be helpful. But when technique is used to armor us up against any kind of suffering, it's a fiction. Because life is an agon. It's a struggle. There is no technique that you can ever apply to your life to ever get rid of your life of suffering. You can't really do anything about the natural disaster. You can't really do anything about the tumor that appears mysteriously in your body. You can't do anything about the freakish car accident. You can't do anything about the reaction of your coworkers when they find out you're a Christian. Suffering is part of living. And I know that many of you here would not come through the door and say, on my driver's license, there's a little label that says humanist underneath. You would never say that. You're not a humanist. As soon as you hear me saying, well, humanism means I'm a God and you're a God, you're like, I don't subscribe to that thinking at all. But I want to tell you, it's in the water. I want to tell you that a lot of people think this way. And because people think this way, and because culture is sort of bends toward humanism, it's going to influence you. And that's why occasionally we need to stand up and say, humanism is demonic. That's why occasionally we need to stand up and say, God is God and you're not. I'm not. How many of you think that's good news? I think that's pretty good news. God is God and I am not. In fact, this would be time for our patented talking to our neighbor. Would you just tell your neighbor, you're not God? Yeah, I love it when friends or people clearly in relationship with one another tell that to one another. It's good to do that every now and again. You're not God. You're not God. You're not God. I mean, the world will teach you that you have enough power to circumvent any kind of suffering, but I think Hebrews gives us a far better reality. That there's pain and there's suffering, but we can endure. Now, please hear me. I'm not saying that suffering can't come from our own doing. I'm not saying that suffering just is because our world is broken. We can make stuff harder for ourselves, can't we? This is why the writer of Hebrews tells us to throw off everything that hinders. This is why the writer of Hebrews tells us the sin that so easily entangles, throw it off. Life is hard enough as it is. Let's not contribute to its difficulty. Everything that hinders, every encumbrance, everything that gets in the way, let's throw it off. You want to make a race a lot harder? Well, I got some CrossFitter friends here today. My CrossFitter friends, you know, you want to make a race a lot harder? You put on a 20-pound vest. We do that voluntarily in CrossFit. Well, I don't, but they do. Anyway. And here's the writer saying, no, throw it off. Cast off every encumbrance. It's kind of like throwing off the excess weight of clothes, as a runner would do in the ancient Greek games. They'd run without any clothes. Why? Because they wanted to run as unfettered as possible. They wanted to run without any kind of restriction. They wanted to run without any kind of weight. And here is Hebrews saying sin is the worst kind of weight because sin's a burden. It makes running a lot harder. Sin weighs on us. It produces guilt and consequences. Guilt clouds. Guilt trips us up. Sin entangles us so that we don't even want to keep running. And notice, by the way, that I'm not saying, and notice that the writer is not saying, if you keep sinning, well, God's going to stop loving you. If you keep sinning, well, God's going to become very angry with you and retributively punish you. No, the writer is saying, throw the sin off because it's really hard to run with sin, with shackles around your knees and a burden on your back. God's going to always love you. He will always offer forgiveness freely because of Jesus Christ. He's not saying cast it off so that you will be loved. He's saying cast it off because it's a lot harder to run when you've got a burden on your back. That's why he's saying take it off, take it off. And by the way, haven't you noticed? This is one of the worst problems about sin. Haven't you noticed that it's awfully hard to believe in forgiveness when you've just done something you shouldn't? Haven't you noticed that? Haven't you noticed that it's an awful lot harder to believe in the gospel of grace and forgiveness when you've looked at the thing you shouldn't have, or when you've said that word, or when you've judged that person, when you've harmed that brother or sister. It's a lot harder to believe that you're forgiven, that you're free when you've just done something you shouldn't have. And the writer of Hebrews knows that. Sin makes everything so much more difficult. And the writer also, I think, is hinting at another kind of sin that easily entangles, and that's the sin that comes from giving in to the type of discouragement that comes from suffering. Now, let me explain. As some commentators have noted, one of the commentators I was reading, like, especially makes note of this. There's sin that can come from acquiescence, from giving in, to discouragement from an unbelieving society's hostility, in the face of suffering. So then, what curdles in us becomes a distrust of God's power and promises. And then what happens is it causes one to abandon the race and fall into unbelief, the unbelief that comes from theodicy, or because of theodicy. Now, theodicy asks, how can there be a good God when there is all this suffering? Have you ever asked that question? In the face of pain, how can there be a good God? This is the question that was being asked, that has been asked for century after century. Because the problem with pain and suffering, as you all know, is that, I mean, C.S. Lewis calls pain like a megaphone. The problem with megaphones, has anybody ever heard someone talk to them with a megaphone? Anybody? We don't really have those nowadays, do we? Does anyone know what a megaphone is? Some of you know what they are? I mean, like, anytime I hear a megaphone, I'm not really listening to what is being said in the megaphone. I'm just like, man, that's annoying. You know what I'm talking about? Like, how can it, does it, maybe we need to put a picture of a megaphone up. But I know that when I've heard a megaphone being shouted at through me, I mean, I guess a loudspeaker, I don't know. I guess we don't have very many of those things anymore. Does anyone have one in their car, a megaphone? Wouldn't that be kind of interesting in the trunk? Do you have jumper cables and a megaphone? You know what I mean? Like, but you know, like a megaphone, see, honestly, like oftentimes when you hear a megaphone, you're just like struck by how loud and annoying that sound is. And that's the problem with pain. It can sound like that. It can be that all-encompassing that all you can hear is the volume of the pain turned way, way up. How can there be anything that you can hear other than the pain? I think that's part of what Lewis is saying. I think part of Lewis is saying the suffering and pain have the tendency of drowning everything else out. And they do so in such a way that they can get us to actually look askance or to take a left turn or look differently away from the real solution in the pain or the real person who can hold us in the pain, the real way that we can endure in the pain, the real communication that's actually happening through the suffering. Not that God causes suffering. He does use it, by the way, for our good. And so I just want to get to how we endure this agone, because Hebrews tells us, here's how we endure. We do two things. We fix our eyes on Jesus, and we consider him who endured. Two things. This is what Hebrews 12 tells us. So Hebrews 12 is essentially telling us that endurance is not a strategy. Endurance is about a who, not a how. It's about a who, not a how. Why is this so important? Because as the writer of Hebrews tells us, we fix our eyes on Jesus because he is the pioneer and perfecter of faith. He's the pioneer and he's the perfecter of faith. Some translations, maybe you grew up with the translation of Hebrews 12, that call Jesus the author and perfecter of faith. Anybody sound familiar? Author, perfecter of faith. What is author? What does pioneer mean? It means that he's opened the way. He makes faith possible in the first place. He's the one. Remember Ben's message from a few weeks ago. Jesus is the forerunner. He's the one who actually opens the way. He makes the way possible. He opens the way so that we can actually go in the first place. He's the one who through his life, death, and resurrection has opened the way for all humanity, as we talked about the better hope, drawing near to God. He's the one who sacrificed himself on the cross to bear the burden of cosmic sin so that we can get there in the first place. We could actually start on the road in the first place. He's the one who makes union with God possible in the first place. Not only is he the pioneer, he's also the perfecter. We talked about perfect. What does perfect mean? It means complete or it means whole. Teleos in Greek. Well, Jesus is the teleoton. He's the one who completes. He's the one who completes our faith, which might remind you of Apostle Paul. When the Apostle Paul says in Philippians, he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. He's the one who starts the journey. He's the one who will help you to finish it. He's the one who's the beginning of the faith. He's the one who is the end of the faith. He's the Alpha and he's the Omega. He opens the door and he holds your hand as you go all the way through, and he even carries you at some points too, because heaven knows we need it. He's the one who begins it. He's the one who ends it. He's the one who will complete our journeys through Jesus Christ. He's the starter. He's the finisher. This is why we fix our eyes on Jesus. We fix our eyes on Jesus because we all need a little bit of divine intervention. I mean, let's be honest. We need a lot of it, don't we? And he's the one who helps us along the way. And so eyesight, fix our eyes, is about vision. Here's Hebrews telling us, make the vision of your life Jesus, the one who helps you all along the way, the one who is a person who loves you and who has opened the way, and he will help you to get there in the end. Vision. You just heard us talk about our church's vision earlier today. Our vision as a church is to, anyone? Join Jesus in the, okay, now we got a slide up, so we can all say it together. Our vision is joining Jesus in the restoration of all things. This is our vision, and it's really helpful to us because it describes what we are as a church pointing to. It helps us what to say yes to. It helps us what to say no to. It helps us to direct us. It helps us, and then it directs our activity. It's a vision. Vision directs us. And if you read any of the literature on vision, you'll read, if you've got a vision that says 10 different things and that's not memorable, well, it's not going to really help you all that much. Prevailing wisdom is that vision should be singular. And so my question for you is, do you have a vision for your life? Now, what does it mean to fix your eyes on Jesus? I think it means partly this. What is your life pointed at? If you had to say, here's what my life is all about with one sentence, what would it be? And Hebrews is arguing, maybe it should be this. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Vision for my life is to say yes to Jesus no matter what. So it's a version of fixing my eyes on Jesus. You know, like my mom and dad who are here, I do talk about them quite a bit. Mom and dad, I think, hi, mom. Hi, dad. they used to ask me all the time, what's your five-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? I never had good answers for those, by the way. I'm sure they were deeply unsatisfactory to my parents. And I used to think, well, gosh, I'm like, in order for me to be an adult, I need to have a five-year plan, or do you have a 10-year plan even? And I just have like never been very good at that. And besides, after a while, I made five-year plans and 10-year plans. It didn't work after a while. I would just get to 5 years and go, well, that didn't work. At a certain point, I just realized, why don't you just tell me what to do, Jesus? And I'll just do it. I mean, I'll fight you a little bit along the way. But why don't you direct my steps? Why don't you be the vision of my eyes? Why don't you be the thing that fills the future And I'll just say yes. What's your vision? Is it singular? Is it multiple? What if your life vision statement was simply some version of everything is in Jesus? Because the promise of Hebrews is you fix your eyes on Jesus, he will direct you. You fix your eyes on Jesus, he will keep you so that you make it to the end. The prize that awaits is this true city, this true heavenly country, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks. We'll talk even more about that. Even in the face of suffering, even in the face of the world and all its brokenness, this is the kind of vision that will keep you. And how do we know that? Well, because Jesus himself suffered. That's the second part. Consider him vision, remember, fix your eyes, but consider him, fix your eyes on the one who endured suffering himself. The one who endured the cross. The one who endured such opposition from sinners. You'll hear apologists talk about how only in Christianity does God himself, does the God himself suffer. No other religious system does God suffer. But look what the writer of Hebrews tells us. He endured the cross. He scorns the humiliation of being crucified, the worst kind of punishment in the Roman Empire. He endured opposition from sinners, those who beat him, those who persecuted him, those who ridiculed him. The upshot is this: Jesus doesn't just see us in our suffering. He doesn't just show us compassion in the suffering. He suffered himself. And he suffered the worst kind of suffering. He suffered. He entered into our world and suffered just as much more than we do. And why did he do it? Well, the text is very clear. He did it for you and me. He did it for the joy set before him. For the joy set before him. What is that joy? What is the one thing that brings him joy that he does not have? Us, you and me. He suffered. He entered into this world. He suffered to put everything back to rights. Suffering and pain show us that we live in a broken world that is in need of redemption. Well, guess who came to redeem it? Jesus Christ himself. He came into the world. He suffered so that we could be reunited, united with him, restored with him. His surpassing joy is that every one of us in this room would make it to the end. And man, we could read toward the end of chapter 12, we would read that what awaits us is a renewed creation. What awaits us is a true city that has thousands of angels in joyful assembly, that has the church of the firstborn. And by the way, he means Jesus himself. Jesus is the firstborn. We're the brothers and sisters. The city that is the new heavens and the new earth. There is a place being prepared for us. This world is not our home. There is a home that is coming. And if we just hang on, if we just fill our eyes with the vision of the beautiful and suffering Christ, we will get there in the end. Because we won't have to get there on our own power. He will help us through his Spirit to make it there. That's the prize. That's what we run for. Every marathon has an end, unless you're running the Chicago Marathon when they used to run it in August and it was way too humid and they stopped the race in the middle. You know what I'm talking about. You know, there's always an end to the race. It doesn't matter how fast or how slow you are, you run. It matters who you run with and who helps you as you are running. And the promise of Hebrews is you will make it to the end if you fill your eyes with the beautiful and suffering Jesus. And oh, by the way, all along the way, you've got people cheering for you. It's like we're running a race and people are watching. There are spectators. Hebrews calls them a great cloud of witnesses. Sometimes it helps to think about the great cloud of witnesses when you're suffering, when you're enduring, that is watching you as you run, that is cheering you on as you run. Maybe for you, maybe I know for me, it's my mom's mother who prayed for me. I think she's cheering me on. Maybe you in this moment can think of some people in your life that make up that great cloud. Here's Hebrews telling us there's a cloud of people that have gone before you that are cheering you on. It is like a race. You're in the Olympics, and you will all get the prize if you make it to the end. I'll get the prize if you make it to the end. Amen. Let's stand.